Thank you for downloading the Culture Club podcast. This week, the guests were the singing trio Sole Mio, the rock star Alice Cooper, and one of Britain's best-loved composers, Sir Carl Jenkins. This is Classic FM, and I'm delighted to welcome Sir Carl Jenkins once again into the Culture Club. Carl, I think we only spoke about 3 months ago when you just heard that you'd been awarded a knighthood in the Queen's Birthday Honours.
Yes, indeed, a couple of months back.
A tremendous moment, and you were obviously quite rightly delighted. Have you been to the palace yet to collect your knighthood?
No, that happens on October the 6th.
Oh, not so long to
so
wait.
So it's
then,
a week and a bit, I think, or whatever. Yeah,
well,
it's
that should be quite
soon.
An exciting day.
Yes, indeed.
Now, I want to talk about your book as well, which came out, I think, earlier this month, Still With The Music, and there's also an album of the same name that's come out at the same time. I wondered if parts of your life were easier to recall and write about. I mean, was childhood a very vivid memory
that
for you?
That was pretty easy, yes. Up until leaving the Royal Academy and first forays into the profession were fairly easy. And then it all became a bit confused, the middle years. There was so much happening in my kind of jazz life and post that. And then since I'd Amos and the Iron Man forwards, that was fairly easy. Those middle years, there were so many albums floating about Soft Machine and jazz. But fortunately, these days with the internet, it is quite easy to find out certain things about myself. And it was extremely useful for dates and when certain albums were released and those kind of things. So all in all, it was put together quite sensibly, I think, the whole thing. And there were four distinct careers. You know, there was the jazz life and the...
You've done so much.
Yeah,
yes.
Indeed.
And Soft Machine, of course.
Yes, and advertising. And then Addie Amos and the Armed Man. All with the same 12 notes, as I say in the book. So,
did you find the whole thing very satisfying to do? I mean, this chance to look back over your life and really go over all the extraordinary things that you've done, because there have been so many and varied careers.
Indeed. I did find it an amazing experience, really, to write it all down and set it all out, and quite therapeutic in some ways. And a lot of personal things in there that people might not know about. I think everyone tells me it's a good read because it is kind of variety in the sense,
yes,
that I've had four careers, all in music, but very different. And it's only the latter one that has really mattered to anyone and to myself. Without the latter one, there'd be no Classic FM for me, and there'd be no knighthood, and there wouldn't have been a book. So the latter part, the latter quarter, is by far the most important.
And what did it actually feel like to have the finished book, the hardback copy, in your hand? That must have been very satisfying.
Oh, it's incredible, yes, because I've been dealing with files and kind of Word documents and proofreading and the rest of it. And I'm not very good. I'm not that computer literate. I mean, I'm good at emails and working the Sibelius music system for composition. But I'm not a good editor of text or kind of intricacies of computer work. So When the book was finalised, together with some photographs, it was great. And it looks good as well,
yes.
I mean, which I think it does.
And that's very important, of course, as well, the look,
yes,
and the feel of,
yeah,
the book.
Yeah.
You mentioned Addie Amos just now. We're actually going to hear that now, Carl. And this is the London Philharmonic Orchestra, and you're conducting. Addie Amos by my guest this afternoon, Sir Carl Jenkins, with Miriam Stockley and Mary Carew. And the London Philharmonic Orchestra was conducted by Sir Carl Jenkins. Does Addie Amos have a very special place in your heart?
It does, because it was pivotal. That and The Armed Man were equally pivotal in different ways. Addie Amos was the kind of culmination of a long period that essentially it came out of advertising music, I suppose. Because I was asked to do something for a particular commercial. And I had some ideas at the time of developing that idea of using the voices more like world music voices rather than European classical voices. So when it happened and kind of broke after the ad, I mean, record companies became involved and it went with Virgin eventually. It kind of summarised where I'd been and the influences I'd drawn from over many years. So apart from the classical bass, there were jazz influences and also a lot of ethnic music in there. So it began, it ended one facet of my life and beginning of another one where I returned to concerts and recording my own music, really.
Yes.
So it was important in that sense, and that was 1995. And then out of that came the approach to write The Iron Man, which was another, you know, pivotal or yes. turning point, really.
You've described yourself as a musical tourist. What exactly did you mean by that?
Well, because I've dabbled in different areas. Well, dabbled is perhaps a too frivolous a word, really, but I mean, I've been quite serious in everything I've done. But when I left, I've always known I'd be a musician when I studied at, first of all, my father, who taught me piano from a very early age, and then music at university in Cardiff, I read music, and then the Royal Academy. But initially, I wanted to be a jazz musician, and that's what I became, of sorts, but there were far better jazz musicians around than me. But that was one period, and as I say, that kind of merged into Soft Machine, which was jazz-influenced, but a lot of progressive rock elements in the music as well. And then moving on out of that into advertising music, and then, as I say, Adiemus. So I've toured through four different kind of genres, as people might say. But whatever I am now wouldn't have happened without that journey, because I learned a lot along the way. I learned a lot from jazz, and I learned a huge amount from writing advertising music, funnily enough, because one was always called upon to write music for, it could be anything, symphony orchestra one day, which was fine, second nature. But I learned a lot about ethnic instruments and world music that was one was frequently asked for. So that all went into the melting pot, as it were, and came out in Adiemus. And I've used those kind of cross-genre references ever since.
And when you compose, Carl, do you find you have to be in a particular place? John Rutter, when he came in, said to me that he has to go to a little cottage, which is away from all his usual daily life, and that's where he can write. Is it the same for you, or can you really write anywhere?
No, I don't need a cottage. I've written most. Adiemus was written in West London, in Hampton Hill, when I lived there, as was some of The Iron Man. And then we moved to a very idyllic place in Wales, returned to Wales. It was a mill house by a stream. And then we moved back to London, where we had two places one time. Essentially now I live in London. But it absolutely makes no difference.
Well, we're going to move on to hear the Laudamus Te from Gloria, another of your compositions. And this is played by the London Symphony Orchestra and is conducted by you. The Laudamus Te from Gloria by my guest this afternoon, Sir Carl Jenkins. The London Symphony Orchestra and the National Youth Choir of Great Britain was conducted by Sir Carl Jenkins. Carl, tell me about composing Gloria.
Well, first of all, as in any work that has an established text, all my works, just to backtrack a bit, most of my works of established classical text or Latin yes. text, like Requiem, Stabat Mater, Gloria, Te Deum. Invariably, I look outside the purely Christian Latin text and draw from other influences, very often from ethnic cultures, different faiths, if you like, see how they perceive the ultimate reality or God or whatever. So that's been a trait of all my work since The Iron Man, essentially, which is kind of universal. So Gloria was a little like that. There's quite a lot of readings from various Abrahamic texts and others. So one with something like that, it's starting with the words and then formulating not a style, a kind of structure and melodic ideas or harmonic ideas that kind of convey what the text says. So that's what I did, essentially. It's what I always do.
Mm. Now, I think you're only one of only three jazz oboists in the world. Is that right?
Three or four, yes. At the time. I don't know what's happened since.
Well, that's quite something. But what was it about the oboe that attracted you to the instrument? It has the most beautiful, plangent sound, I think.
It does. Well, it was my father, actually, when I was about 10, 11, and about to go to Gowerton Grammar School for Boys, as it was then. At that time, free music tuition was available to everyone. You could learn an instrument at school. The instrument would be provided free of charge. The lessons would be free of charge. It was an amazing environment. And sadly, those days have gone. So I started learning the piano with my father from an early age. I was about six. But it was never my natural instrument. I've always played the piano, and I've used it since as a compositional tool or aid and for arranging. But I was average, I suppose. I was better on the recorder, which I'd learned at junior school. So when I went to the grammar school, I didn't know all these instruments on offer, what to start or what to adopt. But my father suggested, why don't you take the oboe? It was his favourite instrument, and I loved the sound of it, so that's what I did. And because I'd played the recorder beforehand, the finger, as in all woodwind instruments, is fairly similar.
Yes.
So once I could make a sound, I was kind of up and running fairly quickly. So it was the oboe. And then when I started playing jazz, that was one of the instruments I played. So yes. I played jazz oboe.
I'd like to ask you about, you've had such a long and varied career and extremely successful. I wonder, what advice would you give to young people who are leaving music college now in the light of your own experience?
So as I said, it's been a series of accidents. I became a jazz musician, then a rock musician, and wrote music for adverts. And now Adiem has created what I do now, and there was no plan to go in this direction. And then The Iron Man kind of took it further. Mm-hmm. So my advice would be, as a composer, to write what one wants to write and be true to what you want to do, really, rather than write in a kind of prescribed fashion. When I was studying at university, everyone was expected to compose. But it was always had to be in a certain atonal style, I suppose, as part of the academic course. But I never felt at home in that environment, which is why jazz appealed to me, because jazz was and will ever be tonal music in keys. And it's more difficult now than ever, because everybody's doing music now in their back room with, you know, MIDI systems and recording. The world's everyone's at it. So it is a lot more difficult. I accept that and can see that.
But really, to be true to oneself, that's the
core of what
you're
saying. Yes, I think so. And, you know, you'll be happier, if nothing else.
Carl, it's been lovely to see you again. Thank you very much for coming in.
Charlotte, thank you.
And we're now going to hear The Sanctus from that wonderful work, The Armed Man.
Charlotte Green's Culture Club on Classic FM.
Well, it's not often that I get three really good-looking young men sitting opposite me in the studio, and it's making an old lady very happy. This is Sole Mio, and I'm delighted that you're back with me. Thank you very much for coming in.
Thanks for having us again.
Now, you were here about just over a year ago, I think.
Yes.
What's been happening in that year? I know you performed at Classic FM Live. What was that like? That must have been quite an experience.
Holy moly! I'm trying to put together what's been happening. I mean, it was an incredible experience, and since then, actually, we've been to a few countries. I'm trying to compile all the events. It's all a massive blur now. I've been to Japan, Korea, had a New Zealand tour again, and at the same time, compiling our second album. So that's all in a nutshell.
You've been incredibly busy. I know. I want to talk about the album in a moment, but first of all, I gather you had a very interesting meeting with Sir Ian McKellen. Can you tell me a bit about that?
That's right. That was actually on while we were opening for Alfie Bow. We were doing opening for his shows, his arena tours, and it was funny. Well, a lady came and approached us. That what was that? That stadium? What was that one?
The
O2. Oh, which is, you know, a ridiculous arena. I mean,
huge.
We walked out and looked at everyone. And we thought, where are we? How do we get here? And it wasn't until after the show when someone came up to us and said, "There's someone that wants to meet you. If you don't mind, do you want to meet him? You know, in backstage." So we said, "Sure." And funnily enough, walked into the back room and there he was, Gandalf.
And he's a big fan. Obviously, loves your music.
He was a big fan, actually. And you know, it was really nice talking to the guys, like especially him with the theatre work and everything. He had amazing tips for us, like how to portray ourselves on stage, how to make it. Because he said, from a distance, you don't know who's talking. So it's like, you should make it like this, should do it like this. So we got these incredible tips from...
Actually, that's really helpful.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And from who better than to give you that? I mean, that's just, you know, one of the stars of theatre. And the soprano Montserrat Caballé, did you have a masterclass with her? Is that right?
Oh, yes, we did. We were on a cruise from France to Barcelona.
Singing. Yeah, we weren't on holiday.
it was a great singing holiday. But while we were in Barcelona, we were lucky enough to be involved in a few masterclasses that she was putting on for students, both locally and internationally. And it was a great experience, mostly because, well, she's one of our greatest idols, you know, from the opera side of things. But also the fact that she was giving us these tips, you know, that she's one of those opera singers who you wish to meet during your lifetime. Yeah. And we're very grateful for that experience.
And presumably, again, you found it really useful, the things that she was telling you and how
Absolutely.
To put that into practice on stage. That must be a tremendous feeling, meeting your musical heroines and heroes.
It is.
Do you have to sort of pinch yourself and think, gosh, is this really happening?
Oh, absolutely.
Now, tell me about the new album. How did you go about selecting the music for that?
It feeds off the first one. So we kind of went with the same theme of things that we grew up with, songs that we know really well. We've also got the core classics, and you know, just things that we found memorable for us. The opening song is Stella, which is one that we've never forgotten. Actually, we heard it once. My brother heard it once from our younger cousin. And since that first playing, he never forgot about it because it was such a beautiful piece and because it was sung by one of the greatest tenors of all time. Yes. And so we've got things like those. We've got a lot of contemporary music that people also really know and love. And, you know, we've done exactly the same as the first album, just adding our own sort of particular twist to it.
Well, look, we're going to talk about rugby in just a moment, but
okay,
but first, I want to hear you all in action, and this is an opera favourite by Bizet. Fisher's duet by Bizet on Classic FM, and we heard the City of Prague Philharmonic Orchestra under Paul Bateman, and the singers were Sole Mio. I'm Charlotte Green, and you're listening to The Culture Club on Classic FM. Now, you're affectionately known as the All Blacks of opera, which I think is a great, great title, so why not talk rugby, especially as the Rugby World Cup is on? I know the answer to this question already, but who's going to win?
Of course Samoa's going to win.
It's going to be a close one. You know, I reckon it's going to be very, very close. New Zealand has a tendency to get very hyped up, and then for the World Cups, something always happens to the All Blacks. But I'm sure this time round, we've got something good going.
It's true that, isn't it? Because, I mean, I would say they're the best rugby team on the planet, and really, they ought to be winning the World Cup every time it happens. Yeah. But that hasn't been the case, has it? It's quite surprising.
Well, I think they're the most consistent team.
Yeah.
But, you know, with World Cups, at any competition, really, you know, it's up to that moment in time. Anything can happen.
That's very true. Are you going to be able to watch them? Will you be able to see them in action?
Sadly not. We do manage to watch one game, but yeah, we definitely want to see a lot more.
Yes, and certainly the final, because my prediction, I'm sure New Zealand are going to be in the final. I mean, I'd love to say against England, but I'm not convinced that's going to happen. I'm really not, sadly. Now, you performed at our Classic FM live concert. When was that? Last September, about a year ago, at the Royal Albert Hall. Yeah. We're doing that Classic FM live concert again this Tuesday. I wonder what you feel about the venue. I mean, it's a huge, huge hall. I think 6,000 people. Is it really daunting coming out and standing on that stage and seeing that sort of vast mass of people there? Or do you just really concentrate on what you've got to do?
I feel like there is sort of that nervousness that comes with performing in front of a large audience, but it's also very exciting. I think that's what we kind of feed off mostly. We try to size up the actual performance before we go out on stage, so that we know exactly what to expect, and we kind of feed off the reaction of the audience as well. So if everybody sees that we're having a good time on stage, I'm pretty sure they'll be having the same sort of experience.
And what does the future hold? What's in store for the rest of the year?
We have a few tours.
Terrific.
So we're touring Australia, Japan, and we're going back to New Zealand to do two big Christmas concerts. And that's to a lot of people, 10,000 plus. So,
do you find touring exhausting? I mean, that must be quite physically tiring. You're moving from city to city, and
it is actually. And I think people don't see that when they come to the concerts. They don't understand, because they see the glitz and glamour side of it, but the traveling and you're constantly trying to keep awake, you're constantly trying to keep the voice safe the whole time, because that's what people are coming to hear. So, you know, it really does take its toll. But I guess if you were to weigh it up against a normal job, like if people say, you are having an experience of a lifetime. Yeah. And that's what comes with the job. You just got to do it.
Well, you make a wonderful sound. So good luck with the album, because I know your debut album was tremendously successful. So I hope you have as much success with the follow-up. And good luck with the touring as well.
Oh,
and thank you very much for coming in.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
Pleasure. I'm Charlotte Green, and I'm with you until 5 this afternoon, before John Brunning steps in to count down the latest top 30 in the Classic FM chart. Now, it's not often that I mention the rock star Alice Cooper on the show. In fact, I think this is a first for me, but he's got a new classical project in store. He was in the UK recently and took some time out to tell Lucy Coward all about it.
Alice Cooper, thank you so much for spending a few minutes with Classic FM.
Yeah, I don't do a lot of things with Classic FM.
Well, you might not want to after we finish.
No, it's fine.
But we're here to talk about your narration for a new version of Peter and the Wolf.
Yes.
Which was originally written by Prokofiev to inspire a whole new generation of youngsters with classical music.
Yes.
And with your new take on it, that's kind of what you're doing for a new generation. So I guess my first question would be, why is it the perfect story to introduce children to a certain type of music?
Well, first of all, it's very thematic. They keep going back to certain themes in the music that's very relatable. Peter is fearless. He's sort of a the kid that doesn't fit in normally, except for the fact that when it comes to the wolf, he has no fear at all. He knows how to handle the wolf. I think that's a great message to kids, you know, is don't be afraid to. The wolf, of course, represents a lot of things, you know, but in his case, he's just not afraid of the wolf. And I think that's a great message. Maybe that's an anti-bully message right there, you know. In modern day, that seems to be the biggest problem right now, is being bullied. Well, don't be afraid of the bully. Don't be afraid of the wolf.
Because I was really interested by the idea that the paparazzi are kind of seen as the big bad wolf in this. And over the years, you must have had so many experiences of how do you strike the balance between using the paparazzi to good effect and also making sure that there's a line that can be drawn where they leave you alone?
There is no line. You cannot define that line. You just have to know how to work it. You know, as far as I was concerned, it's 100 times easier being a nice guy than a jerk. You know, if you're going to fight every paparazzi, Don Quixote, what are you going to do? Go out there, fight every, you know, it's easier to take the picture, sign the autograph, smile. My theory is if they don't want your picture, you're in trouble.
Yeah.
You know, if they don't want your autograph, you're in trouble. So embrace it. Make it part of your daily life. You know, yeah, if they're in your bedroom, it's a different thing. You know, I think that when you walk outside as a celebrity, if you walk out into the public, you belong to the public.
That's your character.
That's, you belong to the public. They go to see your movies. They go to see your shows. They buy your albums. They pretty much own you. And that, you know, people that try to get too private in public, I mean, come on, what do you expect? You know, if a movie star walks in, everybody's going to look at him, of course. You know, everybody wants to know that, you know, there's Johnny Depp or there's Brad Pitt and there's Angelina Jolie. Well, yeah, wow. Of course you're going to look at them, you know. So don't hide.
And do you think that kind of helped people to understand your different, your stage persona and the person that you are when all the makeup's off and off stage?
Well, the funny thing is that nobody has ever really interviewed Alice Cooper. The character I play is only lives on stage. He's never off stage. As soon as I leave the stage, he's gone. So nobody's really ever interviewed that character. But they interview me, who plays the character, and I'm very affable about it. You know, I'm interested in Alice myself because I don't know where he comes from or who he is. You know, it's fun to play him, but I honestly don't have any idea who he is.
So you've never fixed on who Alice Cooper is?
Well,
still discovering.
It's fun to play somebody that you're so opposite of. Alice is sort of this very, he's a total villain, but he's got I think the only thing we have in common is our sense of humor. You know, he's definitely got a sense of humor. If he sees a place to get a laugh, he'll get it. He'll go for it, you know, for the laugh. In other words, if there's a banana peel to be slipped on, he'll go for that. You know, but so, I don't try to psychoanalyze Alice. I just like playing him.
But when it comes to character, what kind of character do you think the narrator will be in your Peter and the Wolf? Because you must have thought somehow how you're going to deliver it. It's not going to be just a question of reading.
No, it was. I got in and I said, I don't know anything about how to do this. I've never done this before. I've never done the narration. So let's see what happens. And it ended up that when the little bird part comes out, well, now I've got to be a little bird. Well, what voice is that?
Well, it's probably a little British voice, you know.
And so the bird ended up being this little British voice, but I didn't plan on it that. The wolf could be loud, but this wolf was very quiet and very dangerous. Almost like a Christopher Lee kind of, you know. So that just came out. I decided the cat was everybody's favorite character, because the cat was just sleazy, you know, the movie star's cat, you know, that lays in the pool with sunglasses on. So the cat was very, you know, this. Should I climb the tree and catch the bird? Can I be bothered to do that, you know? So that character was really funny to play. And then the grandfather. Normally the grandfather is the old Russian grandfather. But this grandfather lived in Hollywood. He's 70 years old, and he was a hippie. So, you know, way, man. Hey, dude, how you doing? You know, and that gave it a whole different perspective of this little Russian boy coming to California and dealing with all these characters now. But all of that was realized in there. When I came in and saw the script, I went, okay, what, you want me to do all the voices? Yeah, okay, let's discover who these people are.
And did it take, was it a long process? Did it take some time?
We did it in 3 or 4 hours, you know. Once we decided who everybody was, then it was, for me, the hard part was doing the narration, doing the voice, and then going right back to the narration again. Because you're jumping from this personality to that personality to that one. And tried to do it in one take. You know?
Well, Prokofiev wrote the music, I think it was in about 2 weeks. So yeah. You were working pretty quickly.
Yeah.
I wanted to know, what's the quickest you've ever written a song?
You know, it's funny, the biggest hits are always the ones that are the simplest songs. A song like Only Women Bleed, I was writing another song, and I heard on the TV somebody, it sounded like somebody said Only Women Bleed. And I thought, what a thought. That song was written in about 10 minutes because my guitar player was right there, and I had this little figure that he was playing, and I said, that is perfect for this. Sometimes the title writes the song. You know, No More Mr. Nice Guy. I already have the rhythm of that. I know what that's going to be. It's going to be very simple, you know, very Lost in America. A great song is when the lyric is married to the chords, is when you get that one phrase that matches the chords, that matches the melody line. This is what I used to do with my wife and daughters. If I was going to write a ballad like You and Me or I Never Cry or How Are You Going to See Me Now, these songs were all big hits. And I would play them for my daughters and my wife. And there was one point in the song where the chord and the verse breaks your heart. It's that one moment where it goes, and I'd sit there and wait and wait and wait, and it would hit, and my wife would go, oh. And I go, yes.
So it's a big collaboration in a sense. You know, no matter who, you don't have to be a songwriter. You involved your wife, you involved your children. It's because, you know, collaboration has become such a big thing for musicians. And there is an app that goes with Peter and the Wolf, and yeah, that's encouraging people to have a different interactive experience. And now people will come to watch you and they will film you or they will live tweet you. How much have you noticed that that makes a big difference?
Well, everybody has a different take on it. You know, and we're living in an age now where everybody's opinion counts. You know, you sort of like, you're basically saying, how do you think? There was never a time in history where you would go to somebody and say, what do you think about this? We have media now where, well, this is what I think. So it's kind of interesting to give the audience a chance to feedback on what you wrote or what you did or your performance, you know.
And my final question then would be, will you give us a chance maybe to feedback on a classical composition? Because your friend Dave Mustaine, he has been known to perform Vivaldi and Wagner and put a completely unique take on it. Have you ever been tempted to do something like that?
Yeah. Night on Bald Mountain would be great. Would love to do that.
When can we see that? When can we hear that, rather?
Well, you know, I mean, it's one of those things where all rock musicians that are prog rock guys will listen to those themes and go, oh, well, that could be really good.
The drama particularly of that.
Yeah, 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 especially dom, 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 dom. That's guitar. I mean, everybody can sit and listen to that and go, yes, I can hear that, you know. Dun, 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 dun. We did West Side Story. We did parts of West Side Story, and nobody realized it. The Jet song, you know, and people say, where is that from? Da, 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 da. And your kids have never heard West Side Story, and they go, what is that? You have to educate them somehow.
You know? Well, come back and talk to us when Night in Bald Mountain, a la Alice Cooper, is finished. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
Thanks again for downloading the Culture Club podcast. I hope you'll join me this coming Sunday from 3, when my guests are Joanna Lumley and the film composer Harry Gregson-Williams.